Thanks for joining us on the Port City Church podcast. More information about Port City Church is available at portcitychurch.org.
Good morning. It's a privilege to welcome all of our campuses together as we continue our series entitled Trapped. And we're talking about authority, and particularly the freedom that is found in authority. Last week, I left you with a question, if you recall. I said, do you know the one thing that God wants from you is the one thing that you can hide from everyone else? And I said, do you know what that is? And we all said no, and I told you I would tell you this week. And so I'm going to do that. About a year ago, I did a series on emotional well-being, mental, anxiety, depression, those things. And it was the title of the series is called Getting Nowhere. It was really about dealing with sort of the rats in our brains. And in that, and this is kind of by way of review, in that we did a kind of a diagram, and it talks about this components of our bodies, our lives, where we work, our minds, our hearts. It's been a year, so I don't expect you to remember this. And then our bodies. Now, I know it's kind of a crude drawing of what you look like, but it's pretty accurate, okay? And we talked about our minds, we talked about our hearts, we talked about our bodies. And it's really important to understand this, because this is the first line of authority that you've been given. Really, the first line of authority that you've been given is within your own self in terms of how you live in this world. And so, for example, the heart is to be guarded. Above everything else, guard your heart, because from it flow the wellsprings of life. Your mind is to be renewed. We are not to be conformed to the image of this world, or the patterns of this world, but we are to be transformed by the renewing of our minds. And in the renewing of our minds, we'll be able to test and approve what it is that God has created us for and asked of us in this world. And our bodies, interestingly enough, are to be forced into submission. I buffet my body and I make it my slave. Our physical bodies are great servants. They are terrible masters. And a lot of us wind up reversing this order. And we've also mentioned, this is again kind of a review, last week I talked to you about the importance of our eyes. Those are eyes. And I had some conversations that talk about that the eyes being the window to the soul. That's how Jesus describes it, or a lamp. And in some places it's translated, it's a window, and it allows things in. So it's this idea of what we see, around us. And this is what we talked about last week, and this is sort of my own kind of way I process the world around me. And it uses these three words, encounter. This is what we experience in the world, what we collide with in the world. When things happen to us that hurt us or harm us, it's because we encountered something that goes inside and it forms us. This formation that happens inside of our hearts that ultimately yields or becomes the expression, the way in which we live our lives. That's how it works. If you were here last week, I explained that a little bit more in depth. But basically, my premise is that everything that we see and experience in this world actually shapes our heart. It actually shapes who we become. If you grow up and you learn that you can't trust people, you're going to live your life distrusting people. If you grow up and whatever has happened to you, the experiences you have shape who it is that you become, and they affect how you live in this world. And the other thing we talked about last week is this connection here and how many of us, because the whole idea is, how do we get to this place here? How do we live so that the way in which we've been created to live actually matches the way that we live and explore that? And authority is a huge piece in understanding this. And that's what we're going to address this morning in a message called The Thing That Matters, The One Thing That Matters. Last week I left you and I said there's a difference between that which captures your or catches your eye and that which captures your heart. There's a difference between that which catches your eye and that which captures your heart. You see, what does it mean for something to grab a hold of us so deeply that we can't help but to do that thing? Okay, that's what we're looking at. And what I've learned in my own life is that my eyes get distracted by a lot of things. And a lot of things catch my attention. And the greater your level of attention problems, the more problems you have with it. So I'm like off the scale. In fact, one of my favorite quotes in the world is from Henry Nouwen. He's a Catholic priest, a contemplative guide. He said that my mind is like a banana tree full of monkeys, And I have found very few things that I resonate with more than that, because that's how I feel most of the time. So I've learned that it doesn't take much for things to catch my eye. And so what winds up happening is our whole lives are lived bouncing from thing to thing to thing. Oh my gosh, that's cool. Oh my gosh, that's cool. Oh, I ought to do that. Oh, I ought to do that. And we never really get to the essence, to the center, to say, what is it that has captured your heart? And I think there are reasons that are valid because we don't know how to do it. We don't know what we're looking for. All those things are true. But I think there's something that's a little bit more deviant that comes into play because we live in a fallen world and we are all so deeply affected by sin. Last week, my premise was really a couple of things, and I'll just do this by way of review, is that freedom requires restrictions. In order for you to truly be free, there have to be restrictions placed upon your life, upon the way in which we live. You can't have freedom in driving without rules, or else you have anarchy and chaos, and we understand that. Authority is what provides those restrictions. Whatever it is in your own life, whatever is in your own life, the authority that you trust is what determines the restrictions in your life. It determines your morality. It determines your ethics. It determines your relational behavior. What is it that you trust? That's what provides the restrictions that you live under or that you ignore, whatever version of that you pick. But authority is the source of those restrictions. And my premise in this is that freedom thrives only under authority. It thrives only under authority. And this is where I want to sort of pick up from last week. And the question we've been looking at is, who has the right to tell you what to do? That's the question. Because I tell you, we live in a culture, there's a lot of issues in our culture, and like we're hitting in that political season that everybody's so excited about. And I know all of you guys probably watched the debate last week, right? You watched Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. It's like, wow, I'm so glad that the Clemson-Louisville game was so much better than that. And so we see this and we hear all these issues. And even for a church, for me, there are a lot of issues that we need to address, a lot of things, important issues in our culture. As I've been wrestling with this for probably the better part of 9 months or so, what really drove it to me is I could do a message, a killer message on any topic. And you go, oh, that's such a good message. And if you don't believe that someone has the right to tell you what to do, it will never, ever, ever change your mind. Because the fundamental problem is not the issue that you're debating. It's the authority that you trust regarding the issue. And if you don't get that right, you will never get the issue right. Now, the way in which we have to handle these things is by getting down to that. Who has the right to tell you what to do? Every human being has to answer that, because that's what you're going to live under. That's what you're going to live under. And you will never solve some of the biggest problems in your own life until you get this one right. And that's what I want to help us do. Because the fact is, it's the idea is, who gets to define truth for you? Who has the right to tell you what is true? We use religion for this. And it's interesting. Let me get to this in just a minute. But ultimately, for every human being, is authority has to be trusted. The only authority you're going to allow in your life is the authority that you trust. Ultimately, it has to be trusted. If it is not trusted, it's either going to be used, it's going to be abused, or it's going to become abusive. If your parents put you, I had a kid. I was a youth minister, and I asked these kids, I had a dog at the time, had a dog. People asked me, do you have pets? I said, no, I have kids. So I'm done with pets. I'm not a pet guy. You can tell me, oh, you're missing out. I get it, I am. But I had a dog, and he was a terrible dog. And I was on a mission trip. And so I got these two kids in my youth group. I gave them keys to my house. I gave them the authority over my domain, my dominion. And I trusted them to feed my dog while I was gone. And so as a youth minister, I used to go to all the high schools and eat lunch. And I was at the high school one day, and I met a bunch of kids that I'd never met before. They said, hey, we were at your house. I said, you were? They said, yeah, we were at your house. I said, I don't know any of you guys. They said, oh, well, we know so-and-so. And they were feeding your dog, and so we all went over. And I was like, I don't even want to know. And so somehow when you can't trust authority, it's either going to be used or abused, or it's going to become abusive. And that's true. That's true. So we're talking about trusted authority here, and this is where we've got to get to in that. It's interesting to me, for a long time, we live in a culture that doesn't value truth in a sense, because we hear things like, what's true for you may not be true for me, and we live into this. We live in this in most facets of our culture, of our society. And it's called relativism. It's called relativism. It's sort of the label that's given to it. And what relativism does is it tries to make everything equally right. And there's a bumper sticker, and I've shared this before, but there's a bumper sticker that I see, and it's really interesting, and it used to make me really mad, and it doesn't anymore. But the bumper sticker is all the religious symbols. You may have seen this. It's all the religious symbols on the bumper sticker, and it spells the word coexist. Have you seen this, right? It's like the cross and the crescent and all the different things that started. And it's trying to say all the religions need to just coexist, and they're all equally right. And what's interesting is you could get the most devout leaders, compassionate leaders, I mean, all the perfect ones, and put them on a stage, and they would tell you that they are not all the same. They would tell you that. That nobody pretends that they're the same. So what is this? So it used to make me go, how can people be so dumb as to not know they're never going to be the same? And then I realized what's really going on. That bumper sticker is really what's wrong with all of us, and that is it is trying to get God's vision on our terms. God is the one who created us to be one as he is one. He is the one who created us to be one united humanity that would live in this perfect union with him in a way that expressed perfectly all the purposes that he had designed for us to live. We're the ones who messed it up, and we sort of created all these different paths to God and ways in which we think, and what we're trying to do is to get God's vision on our terms. And that's what we always do with most of the things where we run up against God. We're trying to get his vision, what he wants for us, which is to be free, and we're trying to get it on our terms. And so we wind up saying things like, well, what's true for you may not be true for me. We sort of all have our own standard by which we live to things, which is really important because relativism fundamentally isn't relative at all. It has a standard that you've got to sort of figure out and find. And you've got to do this in a really careful way. Relativism is important because relativism means that there is a standard that relative truth is relative to. So if I said, hey, John is tall because he's 6'6", you would go, yes, John is tall, unless you're comparing him to a giraffe, right? So when you say John is tall, it's a relative thing, but it's relative to the standard of all the other human beings who are hanging out with him. But as soon as you start comparing him, if you create another standard, all of a sudden, he's not tall anymore. He's actually pretty small or short. And so you've got to be able to think about this because when we talk about relativism, most of us use it as a way to say anything goes. But what relativism is really about is finding the standard that you are using to make your truth relative to. This is what authority you are trusting. I want to use a couple stories from Jesus as he interacts with people who are asking him questions and how he used them. And both of these are found in Matthew. One's in chapter 21 and one's in chapter 16. And so the first one is an interaction where some chief priests and religious leaders come up to Jesus. And they're going to ask him a question. And here's how it goes in Matthew 21, verses 23 through 27. And when he, Jesus, entered the temple, the chief priests and the elders of the people came up to him as he was teaching. And they said, by what authority are you doing these things? Who gave you this authority? This is a great question. By what authority are you doing these things? And who gave you this authority? Because we're kind of in charge of the temple and all the teaching, and we didn't give it to you, so who gave it to you? Where did you get this authority? What they're asking him is, who gives you the right to tell us what to do? Who gives you the right to tell us what to do? Where did you get this authority? Now, Jesus is a genius. I mean, he's God and all, but he's also a genius. This is brilliant. Because most of us think about when you're challenged on who are you to tell me? We bow up, and we present our case, and we're like your mama and the whole thing, right? The whole thing, they get the whole can because you don't challenge me on that. So they come up to Jesus. This is the one who has created everything. They're going, who gives you the authority to do this? And so Jesus answered him. He said, okay, I'm going to ask you one question, and if you tell me the answer, then I will tell you, if you answer me, then I will also tell you by what authority I do these things. The baptism of John, you know the baptism of John the Baptist. All these people are following it. It's created quite a ruckus in our region. You know the baptism of John. From where did it come from? Was it from heaven or was it from man? And they discussed it among themselves. So he's asking this really simple question. He says, the baptism of John, you've all heard about it. It's created quite a ruckus in the world here. And where did it come from? Was it from God or was it invented by John? Which one? And they discussed it among themselves, and they began saying, if we say it's from heaven, then he will say to us, then why did you not believe him? But if we say it's from man, then we are afraid of the crowd because they all believe that he was a prophet. Now, what you see them doing here is they are using their minds. Jesus says, they said, hey, whose authority do you have to teach on? He says, I'll answer that question if you answer me question, whose authority was John the Baptist from? And they're going, so they start thinking, they start putting their minds to work. And they're going, if we tell him it was from God, then he's gonna say, then why didn't you believe him? And we're gonna feel like buffoons, and we don't wanna feel like buffoons. But if we say, oh, we think it's from man, then all the people who think it was from God are gonna kill us, and we don't wanna die. We don't wanna look like buffoons, and we don't wanna die, we're in trouble. What they are doing is they are using their minds not to figure out what is true, but they're using their minds to figure out what standard they're going to use in order to make their decision. This is really important. Because listen to what they say, after all their thinking, here's what they said. Verse 26 says, they answered and said, we do not know. He said to them, neither will I tell you by the authority that I do these things, and the conversation's over. It's kind of anticlimactic. Their thing about this is, we don't know. Now here's the thing. Did they know? Did they know? The answer is yes. They had opinions, they had beliefs about what the question was that Jesus had asked him. What was the problem? The problem was the one thing you can hide from everybody else that God wants from you, and that is your motive. What is underneath? And they're sitting there going, we can't look at buffoons, and we don't want to die. So we're gonna use our minds not to find the truth, but we're gonna use it to conceal the truth. And if you press even further, what you see is you see that they use this. They have established a standard by which they measure truth. What is it? In that conversation, they actually established a standard they were going to use to measure a more fundamental truth than what they were asking about Jesus. And that standard was themselves. We don't want to look like fools, and we don't want to be killed. Our standard has become what makes my life work in the context that it currently exists in. I think a lot of us live our lives like that. I think we measure and we calculate religion, authority, all these about how it's going to work, and our standard has become ourselves. And this is a real problem. You will never get to the issue until you can drive below this. Jesus is driving them to the one thing that they're able to conceal. And what we realize is they're not looking for the truth at all, but they're rather looking for a way to conceal what they believe so as to keep them out of trouble. Now, what a lot of folks do is they use commands as sort of their excuse. And we talked a lot about this last week. Remember, I said, how many of you, you know, anybody told you not to look, told you to look both ways before you cross the street, or commanded you not to go in the street unless you held their hand? And if you're over four, no one told you that. And you did it automatically. The reason is because you were commanded that so early on, it has actually formed and shaped your heart that you realize that's what you wanted all along, was to be able to walk in the street and live, and the rule helped you do that. And now you obey it from the heart without thinking about it. That's what we talked about last week. And my premise is, if that is true of that rule in your life, I believe it can be true of everything that God has asked us, that somehow if we can encounter and really understand this, we can obey from the heart in a way in which the way in which we live, in the way in which we live our lives becomes a natural expression of His life in us. I believe that it's possible. I believe that's what His power does in us. And so, we said commands serve as placeholders until we can want what we actually want. That was from last week's message. They serve as placeholders until we can want what we actually want, until we obey from the heart. And so I always remember thinking, is the most important thing I can do is to obey? Is that the most important thing I can do? When you tell your kids to be home at a certain time, is the most important thing they can do is obey? You want to say yes, but that's not true. You want them to want it. I remember thinking about this with my girls. I have two girls, and when they were small, like 4 and 5, I could make them hug me because I was faster than them. I could catch them. And I could grab a hold, and I could take their arms, and I could force them. I could make them hug me, but I could not make them want to hug me. And which one do you think that I want? That's the picture. At some point, there's only something underneath that only they can tell, and that's what I want. I think the same thing is true for God. When he says in John 14, 15, if you obey me, you'll keep my commandments. If you love me, keep my commandments. We read it and we question our love. Well, I don't keep his commandments, so I must not love him. And we get this whole thing backwards. What I believe he's calling us to is if you can set your heart on him, if you love him, guess what will happen almost instinctively? As we learn to allow him to capture our hearts, obedience becomes expressive, and it's supposed to be expressive because that's what it's designed. The reason I obey God is not because I'm trying to keep his rules, but because the obedience that he commands actually allows me to represent his image, and that is exactly what I was made for. Let me see if I can help explain this, because I always talk about the image of God. And if you've been around a long enough time, you know that I believe fundamentally that every human being was made by God and for God. Your life was created for him. For him. You're made in his image, and you will not find freedom until you find that. Years ago, probably in the very early days of Port City Community Church, I used to live as the first house I built, but I lived in this neighborhood. It was a big neighborhood, and it had a HOA, a homeowners association. Y'all know what these are, right? These are like sort of oppressive groups that are put together to enforce the will of the People's Republic of Amber Woods, okay? So I volunteered for some of these things, and I could not believe some of the rules that they came up with to keep people from diminishing their property values. And so one of the rules we had in our neighborhood, and I'm not gonna tell you the name of the neighborhood because it's a good neighborhood. It is. But one of the rules was you could not park in the street in front of your yard or they would fine you. And so I didn't. I'm a compliant guy. I'm like, okay, I'm not going to park there. But someone on my street or on the street near me parked their car in front of my house for like a week. And so I got tickets and warnings, and then I got fined. And so they sent me a bill in the mail. You're fined. Like, it was like, I think I said $50. I think it was like $100. You're fined $100 for this car. And so I called. I said, "That's not my car." They're like, "We don't care." I'm like, no, it's not my car. Like, I don't know whose car it is. They're not sitting at my house or not my house. I don't know who, somebody from somewhere else. They're like, "We don't care." I said, "I want to appeal." They're like, "You don't get an appeal." I'm like, last time I checked, we live in the United States of America, and you cannot just levy taxes for, or maybe you can. I'm just kidding. Just kidding. Sorry. You can't do that. That's what I said. You can't do that. And they're like, "Yes, we can." I'm like, I'm not going to pay you. They said, "Then you're not going to get your pool pass." I said, "Oh, I have kids. You can't do that to me either." And so now we're embroiled in this battle. And I called, and I'm not. But this time, my blood is boiling. And it had been a long time at that point in time since I'd gotten angry like that. I was angry. And so I will tell you this authentically. And I called up. I got all the way to the top person, and I let him have it. I mean, both barrels full bore. You don't even blah, 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 blah. And I hung up the phone. And God said, "Call him back and apologize and ask him to forgive." It's like instantly something on the phone. "Call him back, apologize, and ask him to forgive you. You were wrong." I said, "I was not wrong. It cannot fine me for somebody else's car." So I didn't spend a lot of time trying to justify, and for whatever reason, I picked the phone back up and I called. And I called, and I got all the way back up to the guy, and I said, "This is Mike Ashcraft," and I'm sure he's going, "Oh boy, here we go again." And I said, "This is Mike, and I need to apologize to you for speaking to you in the way that I did, and I need to ask you to forgive me for that." And then before I could even really calculate or think, the next words came out of my mouth, and I said, "Because my mom did not raise me like that." And I thought, what does my mom have to do with this? So I thought about it. He forgave me. We were cool. But I thought about it. What does my mom have to do with this? Because somewhere I realized that I had acted in a way that would violate the image of the one who had given me birth. And I did not want him to think about my mom the way he was thinking about the way I acted. It was inside, just like that. Why? Because deep down in every human heart, we are image bearers of something. We want to represent the thing that has given us life really, really well. And we don't represent it well. That's what we confess. I'm confessing to this guy because what I did would reflect poorly on the image of the one whom had given me life. See, now what if I would have said, I got to call him back, because what if he goes to Port City Church? What's the motive then? Whose image am I concerned about then? Mine. Do you see how quick this happens? This is what sin does. This is why this is so hard. To think about the things that capture your heart is so hard because our minds are so convoluted, calculating and trying to contemplate, how's this going to look? How am I going to make sure that my world stays intact, that my image stays intact, that the way in which I've arranged my life stays intact, and I'm going to take and use that as my standard to gauge every truth, even the truth of God, because I'm afraid of the implications it has on my current way of life. You've got to get there. You've got to get there. You see, a lot of us, what we do is we calculate. We start to think, well, you know, I'm not really sure if I believe that, or I'm not really sure. And then we go and we research and we build all these arguments. I can't tell you, I've researched many of the issues from sexuality to evolution, creation, to all, I mean, just, and what you basically see is there is an enormous, gigantic amount of information and factual assessment on both sides of every issue. There's opinions, there's all sorts of stuff on both sides of every issue. And when you really boil it down, I don't think most of the problem has anything to do with anything that's on either side. It has to do with what's underneath both of them, and it is what you want to believe. I want to show you this, and this is another place where Jesus, because a lot of us say, well, I don't have enough evidence. I don't know that I believe that because I haven't been convinced in my mind. I haven't been convinced in my mind. So Jesus has another encounter. This is in Matthew 16. And this is where some Pharisees, some religious leaders, people who are a part of the people of God are coming to Jesus. And in Matthew 16, verses 1 through 4, it says, and the Pharisees and Sadducees came, the religious leaders, and he speaks to their motive right here, and they came to test him. They came to test him. And they ask him to show them a sign from heaven. And here's what they're asking. They're saying, Jesus, we hear you talking about the Messiah and being God, and we hear all your stuff, but how do we really know that you're who you say you are? We don't really have enough evidence to believe you yet. How many of you guys ever heard that before? Have you ever had someone come to you and say, I don't know there's enough evidence for me to believe in Jesus? And maybe that's where you are. I don't know if there's enough evidence for me to believe in Jesus. That's a legit question. But as he's speaking to their motive. Why are they asking this? They're asking us to test, and they're basically saying, we don't like what you're saying, and so what we're going to try to do is to pretend that we don't have enough evidence to believe what you're saying. That's their whole posture. And so here's what they ask. And Jesus, or here's what they came to him, and they said, hey, we want to see a sign. Show us a sign. Do something cool for us, because we don't have enough evidence. And so Jesus says, when it's evening, you say it will be fair weather, for the sky is red. And in the morning, it will be stormy today, for the sky is red and threatening. You know how to interpret the appearance of the sky, but you cannot interpret the sign of the times. Now, a lot of people take this and they use it as like an end times kind of passage, and I think there's application there, but I think that's a little bit jumping the gun. What he's basically saying to them is, you know how to use your brains to figure out what you need to know or what you think you know, but you refuse to use it for these other things. Because you know that red skies at night, sailors are light, right? You know this. And what's the motive here? Maybe they're sailors and they're going, or maybe they want to get on the ocean or on the Sea of Galilee and they're going, hey, red skies at night, you know, tomorrow's going to be really good, and so we're going to be good and we want to live, so we'll sail. But if the red sky is in the morning, then it's going to be stormy and we don't want to die, so we're going to stay put. And they're always calculating as to what works for them. And he says, you know how to interpret these signs. You know how to use your minds to think about these things. You know how to use your minds to think about these things. And look at what he says. An evil and adulterous generation seeks for a sign, but no sign will be given except the sign of Jonah. So he dropped the mic and he walked out of the room. Jesus is awesome. And you're like, they're like, what was that? Like, what was that? You had a evil and adulterous generation looks for a sign. And they're like, what does sex have to do with this? I mean, what's adultery got to do with this? And he's pushing on something. He's pushing on something. I think they did, and if you've ever, like, at least for me, the deeper I've gotten in my prayer life, the more I see this. When I'll say, God, here's what I'm thinking. And then he'll, like, give you something. You're like, what was that? Like, what was that? Can you not just give me a straight answer? I'm tired of the questions. Just give me a straight answer. He says, oh, an adulterous generation looks for a sign. And you kind of do the math. I'm looking for a sign. An adulterous generation looks for a sign. I must be a part of an adulterous generation, or worse, I must be the adulterer myself. And now you're having to kind of figure this out. And so you begin to ask yourself, what is adultery? What's the problem with adultery? Because you know it's not just sex, because even Jesus would talk about it in terms of our minds, of our thoughts go there. And what adultery is, it's fundamental unfaithfulness. It's giving yourself to something that you weren't made to give yourself to in a context that wasn't made to handle it. And what he's saying to them is, you're the people of God, and you were made for God, and you're giving yourself to other things. You're giving yourself to other things. You're enslaved by the pursuits of money or wealth or comfort or security. You're pursuing all these other things to keep your world in order, and you're refusing. And then what you're doing, you're making it worse, is you're pretending that you're looking for evidence to say that you don't really believe in me. But that's not what you're looking for at all. The truth is not about the evidence. You're just unwilling to submit. It's just an unwillingness part. You had no intention of obeying me anywhere. And the problem is, a lot of us don't get to this level in our hearts. You've got to get to this place in your heart. It determines why you do the things that you do. I mean, think about it. As a parent, why do you command your kids to go to their room? Because they've been bad? No, because you don't want them to be bad in front of you. Go to your room and you'll be out of my hair. What is your motive? What's underneath? And listen, every parent's done that. We've all done it. But what happens is, when it goes untested, what happens to us? It becomes the default. Then everything becomes about, how do we keep my life working in the least amount of resistance, in the most efficient and effective way? How can I raise low maintenance, functional kids that basically make my life better? And it just drifts in just like that. And you forget that what you need is, you've been empowered and entrusted with authority to empower them to come alive and to be free. And it is so hard to remember when they are on your last nerve, but you've got to, because this is where motive comes in. It is all about what is underneath those places. Otherwise, you start playing games with everything. Well, I'm not really sure if I believe that, or I don't have enough evidence to believe that. And you start playing games with everything. Do you know how continually I have to do this? I mean, for me personally, I'll just tell you real authentically, it happens to me all the time. Because there are times I get to stand up here. I have to stand up here. Sometimes it feels like I have to. And you know what runs through your mind every once in a while? Oh my gosh, I hope I'm good. I need to be funny. Because if I'm not, they're not going to like me. And if they're not going to like me, I don't think I can take it. And all of a sudden, what happens? Where's the motive? If you don't check it, where's the motive? I just use you. I just use you to make sure that I feel good about myself. And it happens just like that. And you got to drive back and drive and say, God, what is the motive really? God, help me. Help me to want what you want. Help me to want to be a part of what you're doing, to bring people into your presence and to help them process and hear from you and to ultimately help them walk with you in a relationship that changes their lives. I've got to get there. That has to capture my heart, because it doesn't always catch my eye. Sometimes it's all the other stuff that's catching my eye. And you've got to do the work to get to that place. And I always tell people, I said, you know, 100% motive may not be possible in this world. I think there's always like about a 5%, because Satan is always gnawing at you, telling you a lie. But I will tell you, it is so important to do the gut check, to do the motive check on these things, because it keeps us from playing the kind of games with Jesus that we see these other guys playing with him, that I've played with him, and perhaps you've played with him as well. Because what winds up happening, remember we talked this last week, if you can justify why you don't have to trust God, why he's not right about that particular thing, then you will always justify your disobedience to him. And it comes down to who has the right to tell you what to do. You see, and this is for me, and I hope it helps you, but what I've realized, because surrender's hard. Surrender's hard. But I don't know that surrender is as hard as we make it. And what this kind of thinking has helped me with is to realize that oftentimes we're not really available to surrender because we serve other masters. It's not that I'm not willing to surrender, it's just my heart has already been captured by other things. And it happens. It happens. So my challenge to you, I had a guy come this morning after the service and he says, I've had all these bad experiences and it's really made me sad and distrustful and hardened toward the world. I said, right. He says, I keep trying not to be sad and hardened and distrustful of the world. I said, that's never gonna work. You gotta see something different. You gotta see something different. What is it that captures your heart? John Piper's written a fantastic book called Think, incredibly written. But in there he talks about this and he says, our self-centered hearts distort our reason to the point where we cannot use it to draw true inferences about what is really there. About what is really there. We can't even draw inferences about what is really there. If our disapproval of God is strong enough, then our sensory faculties and our rational faculties will not be able to infer that he is there. You can so convince yourself that he is unworthy to be trusted, that you will live your whole life justifying the fact that you don't have to be obedient to him. And the price is you'll never be free. You'll never be free. So what I want to ask you, what I want to leave you with is this thought. In order for your heart to be captured, it must first be available. And everybody goes, of course it makes sense. But what I want you to do is I want you to press a little bit further. I want you to press a bit further because I want you to not just go, oh yeah, that makes sense. But I want you to go, if my heart's not captured, is it because by God, by his love? And that's what the gospel is. God knew that our hearts would only be captured by a love that is everlasting and full and perfect. Perfect love casts out fear. And that would be displayed for us in him giving his son Jesus for us so he would set us free. If the son sets you free, you're free. And that's what he's talking about. And that love is available to us, but oftentimes our hearts already are kind of being given to these other places or other things. And I want to just ask you, is it really available to be captured by his love? Be captured by his love. You know, I was talking to another folks after the service, and it's a new couple. They've been married just for a little while. And we were talking about motives. He said, I don't really understand. I said, have you ever done anything for your wife and you just wanted to do it just to give, just to be for her only? He said, yes. I said, have you ever done anything for your wife thinking that, oh, wow, if I do this, then she'll do that? And he kind of paused, and she's like, I said, he has. And he had to think about it. And as he thought about it, you could see the lights going on. And I said, that's the point. The point isn't to feel bad about it. The point is when the lights go on, you can actually begin to realize that you've given your heart to other things that you really didn't want to in the first place. And you just come back and you say, God, let me see. Let me see what it is that you want. Let me see your perfect love for me. Let me sense your perfect love. Let me encounter your perfect love for me. Because when you encounter his perfect love, it's going to drive out the fear that you have of not being full and of not being free. And when that fear is gone, you will find yourself free to live out the image in which you have been made. So what has captured your heart? Let's pray together. God, thank you. Thank you for your goodness to us, for the authority of your word in the form of your son Jesus, and your word in the form of the scriptures that you have given to us, in the form of the commands in which you have graciously invited us to trust you. Father, I know there are folks in this room and they struggle to trust because they have encountered one bad thing after another. God, everything is driven. I pray they would encounter your love. God, there are those who are here who their life has just been one ability to get people to do stuff and they have a different motive. God, there are those here who struggle with insecurity, paralyzing insecurity, and they have a different motive. God, help us to get underneath to find what has captured our hearts. That ultimately our hearts would be captured by you. That's what I ask for. That's what I pray for. Father, that we might find the fullness and freedom to bear the image of the one who has given us life. And I ask this in the name of your son, Jesus Christ. Amen.